This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we have James Petras talking about the expansion of the war in Afghanistan.
It's not only an expansion by the United States, it's a brutal expansion by a man named McChrystal, appointed by Obama, who's a killer.
Gringo, A Coming of Age in Latin America, a really fine book written about 28-year-old Chesa Boudin, who'll be our guest on Law and Disorder.
Chesa, in 8 to 10 years of travel through many countries in Latin America, looks not only at his own life, but at the costs that neoliberalism has had on the peoples of Latin America and the fact that they're fighting back. Stay with us.
Michael, I noticed you looking at your BlackBerry, and you got an update from the Italian case that's been going on involving the Egyptian cleric Abu Omar?
Yes, we've talked about this case before. As listeners may remember, 26 agents, I think, is that right, Heidi?
Yes,
26 CIA agents and 7 Italian agents of sorts are on trial for kidnapping an Egyptian cleric, Abu Omar, from the streets of Milan, Italy, sending him to Egypt for torture. Amazingly, because Italy has a relatively independent, in fact, very independent prosecutor, Armando Spataro, who is the prosecutor or the investigating judge, whatever the correct term is, Italy, has proceeded on this case and has been holding a trial. There was an attempt to stop this trial over the last 6 months by the Berlusconi government. They appealed the whole case to the Constitutional Court, which said that Spataro had gone beyond some of what he was allowed to do by using classified evidence. The case then went back to Spataro. He looked at it with the other judges who he's working with on the case, the other prosecutors, and said, we have sufficient evidence to go forward in this case against the CIA agents and the Italians with unclassified evidence or evidence that is not deemed inadmissible by the Constitutional Court. So the case is going forward. It has major repercussions. CIA guys, we know the names, or at least he does, many of them, they can't really travel very much, if any, in Europe at all. There's arrest warrants have been issued for them within Europe. So it's an important case.
It's important also in that it's really the first case that examines the American practice of extraordinary rendition.
Right. It starts with forcible kidnapping, which is what happened in Abu Omar's case, bundling him into some kind of a package, coffin, whatever, sticking him in a who knows what else, in an airplane. And
first they flew him to Germany, so the German government is complicit in all of this. Then they sent him over to Egypt.
So they took him to an Italian base in Germany first. They flew him from the American air base in Italy to a base in Germany, and then Egypt, where he claims he was tortured.
So this is a very important case. They've been trying to get rid of it for a long time. Armando Spataro is dogged about it, the prosecutor, and he's been great. And this case is going to continue. I think the trial date now for the continuation is May 27th. They've had people testify, and ultimately, you know, there very well could be convictions in this case. Heidi, it's getting to be the end of the Supreme Court term. It ends really at the end of June. But toward the end, we get a flurry of decisions usually from the court. One of them I know concerns back pay, equal pay, particularly for women. What kind of decision did we get on that?
We got a bad decision if you believe that an ongoing practice of something that became illegal but is now continuing is discrimination. And that's the case here. 4 retired AT&T employees who had taken maternity leaves way back between 1968 and 1976, before the law mandated employers to offer pregnancy leaves on equal terms with other disabilities, well, the women left and they were denied full credit in their pensions for those leaves. And the ruling that occurred last week was 7-2, all agreeing that this kind of pay discrimination is now illegal, Justice Ginsburg noting in her dissent that the ongoing denial of equal benefits in the form of their pension is illegal right now.
Right. It's interesting because what they're saying is that because we weren't paid when we were pregnant, that our pensions are less than other people who were paid for other disabilities. And even though that's something that they're getting either now or going forward, that the court 7-2 said, no, we're not going to do that. And so it's a bad ruling on this. Of course, Justice Ginsburg in the two was probably the foremost women's rights litigator before her time on the court. There's another case concerning the right to counsel and criminal defendants and what happens when you have a right to counsel and whether the FBI or the state or whether the police can still question you after you have an attorney without first checking with the attorney. What happened here?
This is a huge setback for Sixth Amendment jurisprudence. Essentially, the longstanding case that allowed that protection has now been overturned. And the high court said it is all right to question an individual even though he or she has asked for a lawyer. It really goes to the heart of the right of counsel.
Sixth Amendment. Actually, what's amazing about the case, in 85, Justice Stevens decided that once you had a right to counsel, once you had a lawyer, this person in the case that they decided last week actually had a lawyer. And even though that person had a lawyer, the defendant had a lawyer, they went to the defendant and they got him to talk and to write a statement and they took him out to the crime scene. They never told the lawyer. And the Supreme Court, shockingly, in a 5-4 decision, overrode the decision from 1985 that Justice Stevens wrote. And of course, Stevens wrote a blistering dissent, which he actually read into the record at the Supreme Court. So that's only, what, 15 plus 9 is 24 years ago this precedent has been on the books. And with a 5-4 decision made up of our fine justices, Alito and Roberts, shooed in there by Republicans and, of course, Democrats as well, gave them the majority they needed to override a long-term precedent.
And wasn't part of the rationale by the majority that Miranda offers all the protections needed?
You'd have to explain that to the listeners. What is Miranda?
Well, Miranda, if any of you watch television, police crime dramas especially, police have to read you your rights. The Miranda v. Arizona decision came out in the early 60s, basically provided that anything that you say can be used against you in a court of law, you have the right to an attorney, and you have the right to be silent. And now the justices are saying, oh, that covers what had been well-settled law, that once you have asked for an attorney, you can no longer be questioned.
So really what they're saying is even though you have an attorney and you ask for an attorney, you can still be questioned. Seems to undercut, you know, much of the rule. Michael Smith?
Well, the reason they got this 5-4 is that it was Kennedy, wasn't it, that went over to the majority on this decision? And they've got four solid right-wingers on the Supreme Court now.
That's Scalia,
Alito, Roberts, and Thomas.
Right. So they got a core of four, a gang of four.
They got a gang of four, and they went over Kennedy's swingman. Souter's leaving. Souter was on the liberal side on these questions. He's going, and it looks like Sotomayor is going to get, I think hands down, is going to get the Supreme Court position.
And we'll probably be okay
and,
on
and you still have four solid rightists on the court, and she's no liberal.
And well, she's going to, on this issue, she might be okay, but you're still going to get a 5-4 decision because Kennedy is still, you have the rock hard four, and Kennedy's swinging back and forth.
That's right.
So, and these four guys, Scalia, Thomas, Alito, and Roberts, I don't see them changing for many years. I mean,
yeah,
many
that's the other
years.
Problem. They're young.
Yeah, it's many years. So we have with us a rough time. Here we go again. More and more on Afghanistan and Pakistan, unfortunately. Last week, Obama appointed General Stanley McChrystal to head the U.S. and NATO military command in Afghanistan. Another decision that reveals how deeply enmeshed the United States and Obama is and will continue to be in Afghanistan. Today, to discuss the appointment of General McChrystal is James Petras, a former professor of sociology at Binghamton University. In a recent article, Obama's Animal Farm, Bigger, Bloodier Wars, Petras outlines how McChrystal's past brutal leadership is marked by systematic torture, bombing of civilian communities, and extrajudicial assassinations. So here's what we can expect in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Not just more of the same, but much worse. Petras compares it to Operation Phoenix in Vietnam, the notorious program where U.S. CIA and others murdered 25,000 political and some not political Vietnamese.
Jim Petras, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for the invitation. I'm ready to go.
Well, Jim, you know, both Michael and I have read your latest web posting, Obama's Animal Farm, Bigger, Bloodier Wars Equal Peace and Justice. And you particularly talk about the new appointee to head up the war in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal. And what do you think the significance of Obama appointing McChrystal to do this is?
Well, I think it's very clear that he wants a bigger and more ferocious counterinsurgency program. He understands the U.S. has retreated, lost enormous amount of territory in Afghanistan over the past year and a half. Secondly, I think he's very concerned because the entire Pakistan-Afghanistan border is supporting the resistance. I think indigenous anti-colonial forces have taken over inland from the territories, influence, political influence. So he's going all out now. They pressured Zardari, the puppet president of Pakistan, to launch this massive humanitarian crime against the Pakistan people, creating 2 million refugees, and he's throwing $100 million. It's about 10 cents to every refugee. The overall picture that we get is a tremendous boost to militarization. Bush never created 2 million refugees in Pakistan. The U.S. policy is directly responsible. If you look over the last couple of months, one attack after another on the Pakistan military, its incitement to generalize violence, to make a huge commitment, that's what's happening in Pakistan. That's directly the refugees and destruction and civil war that they're launched is directly a product of the U.S. Stranglehold over the new president. I think we have to attribute it to that. And I think McChrystal is gung-ho more than anybody else under Washington, under the Pentagon. He's the person that will pursue that policy.
Well, now, that's what I wanted to ask you about, Jim Petras. Give us some of the background of McChrystal. He was Bush and Cheney's favorite general. He came out of these special operation teams. Talk to us about the significance of picking somebody like him to run the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Well, what it means is a greater effort to destroy the social networks. That's what his specialty is. It's like Planned Phoenix in Vietnam, to go into the villages, to go into the tribal areas, assassinate local leaders, whether they're part of the armed resistance or not. That's what the hit teams. He was not only in special operations, but he was in the a great proponent of direct action, which is strictly involved in U.S. terrorist operations, slitting throats, strangling anybody that's anywhere remotely connected with the armed resistance. I think we have to realize that the difference between McChrystal and the others is that some distinction was made between civilians and armed fighters. And I think McChrystal's approach is to go in and empty the pond to catch the fish. And emptying the pond means devastating areas where the armed resistance seems to have a sympathetic audience, communities, villages, so that the cost of the McChrystal approach is going to escalate. We're seeing that being applied on a large scale in Pakistan. They're going in and driving out millions of people, supposedly to catch a few thousand resistance people.
You know, Jim, I saw an article, I guess, recently about that there's a million or a million and a half already.
Two million.
2 million internal refugees in where? In Pakistan?
Yeah. Yeah. And they have absolutely no preparations for this. And the U.S. has announced a $150 million contribution to 2 million refugees. That's not going to buy them a rice bowl. I think we have to realize that this is a monstrous humanitarian disaster compared to, and this is in the major newspapers, they're comparing it already to the Rwanda refugee flight. This is in the standard capitalist mass media. They've made these comparisons. And this is part of the new Obama approach. Extremism. I think the best word to describe Obama's commitment to Afghanistan, Pakistan, is this is the ultimate in extremism.
There's obviously a whole bunch of military people and others who, are, as you said, want to go back to the Phoenix program, have put essentially a killer in charge of the war in Afghanistan, a Phoenix
and
killer.
And Pakistan. And I think it comes from various sources. Holbrooke's appointment Holbrooke came back with the message that we're losing Afghanistan. The opposition has advanced up to the gates of Kabul. Hillary Clinton saying that the Pakistan army is retreating and giving over to the anti-U.S. forces, anti-imperialist force, giving them too much leeway. So it's not coming from some kooks. It's coming from people that he's appointed who've painted a picture that we're on the verge of a great defeat. That information comes in with Gates and Jones that don't believe that there's any way the U.S. can accept a defeat, and therefore we have to go into a different mode, which is an all-out war, and an all-out war in which civilians are going to take major hits. The Financial Times says this is going to be an extremely destructive, particularly to the civilians involved.
Jim, how do you link up this with several recent developments? Obama's refusal to turn over those 2,000 photographs, the fact that they're not going to close Guantanamo, the military commissions that they've just reestablished. It seems that there's much more continuity with the Bush administration than a discontinuity.
Someone like McChrystal Lynn and the special forces were deeply involved in assassinations, tortures, interrogations. So you're going to publish pictures demonstrating what these people are at a time when you're appointing their maestro as the major figure in Afghanistan, Pakistan. You can't do that. That is, you can't publicize the worst activities of the person that you appoint to be the head honcho in this phase of the war. Secondly, torture is inevitable with McChrystal in command of the operation, so you also want to cover up for the terrible abuses that were carried out under his command.
Let me ask you about his command for a second, because I'm not sure all our listeners are familiar with the command that he had in Iraq and what those forces were. They're called Delta Force and what else?
SEALs, Delta Forces. I was at Fort Bragg in the 80s, and I interviewed people there, including a lieutenant colonel. In fact, I was in a debate there on Central America condemning U.S. involvement with the death squads. Afterwards, they actually invited me to a barbecue, and at this informal setting, they told me what we thought we knew anyway, that these are killing operations. Delta is a no-surrender outfit, and the people that go into it are psychopaths. That is, they enjoy engaging in this hand-to-hand fighting and assaults, that they were looked upon as the dirty war people in the military. And this is people that advised the militias and death squads in Central America. They're bad-talking Delta because Delta they saw as pure and unadulterated killers, in the same way that we would look at any kind of mafia hitman. They're not people there to talk, to engage in counterinsurgency propaganda, to win hearts and minds, as the expression goes. When they get orders, it's go out and take them out. That's what Cheney and all these vicarious assassins, they got their rocks off by being associated with them. Just like David Horowitz, the right-winger, used to enjoy going down and with the Contras in Central America with the killers and taking pictures of them. The kind of vicarious pleasure of associating with gangsters. That's the same thing we're getting now. I think Obama thinks he's going to be flexing muscles and impressing the right wing by appointing these kind of people to top position. And it builds a bridge to the right wing of the Republican Party. It builds bridges back to the worst parts of the Bush administration, which he's always been a proponent of conciliating the Republicans. He calls it keeping the doors open. Well, in this case, it's building bridges rather than opening doors.
Jim, how do you relate this to keeping the military commissions going now with Guantanamo, the whole refusal to renounce the surveillance on American citizens? The whole package that we got under Bush seems to be thriving.
Yes, because Obama has accepted the general paradigm of the past presidents, that U.S. power in the world is built around military conquest, projecting military power. He has a vision of military-driven empire building rather than recognizing that in the contemporary world, much more power is achieved through economic expansion, through investments, through trade. The contrast with China is overwhelming. I mean, China has now replaced the United States as the main trading partner with Brazil. While Obama's pushing this military offensive in Pakistan, China has just signed a $10 billion trade agreement with Brazil. That's four times the trade that the United States engages in Brazil. I think the contrast in contemporary terms is overwhelming.
Let me ask a question about this, Jim, because I remember you've probably read that book by Paul Kennedy that talks about the fall of empires. And as they become major empires, they're more and more their budget goes into military, and therefore they don't become as economically powerful. Now, whether that's true or not, is that an analogy, though, that may be playing out here between China and the United States?
Well, I think it goes back a while. I think in general terms, I'm not sure that all empires end up driving their expansion through military activities. I think one has to draw a line. Europe has moved from military-dominated empires to economically-driven empires. So it's a remake of the conception of empire. It's a recognition that independent states can equally be lucrative. I think the fact that the U.S. is resorting to the old colonial models of military conquest, military definitions of power, it comes from the defeats in Vietnam and the consequences with Carter's relaunching the Second Cold War, with Reagan, etc. The original thought was they could do both, economic and military expansion. And in that contest, with the decline of U.S. manufacturing, industrial power, the rise of finance capital, there was no counterweight to the military side of empire building. And they had an open road at that point, the military, because the finance doesn't depend on economic conquest of markets, and finance has its own dynamic. So you had two parallel paths to world power. One was finance, one was military. Other countries like Germany, for example, China, Brazil, etc., their main driving force has been agro-mineral industrial exports, and the U.S. has only been exporting these financial operations, which ultimately led to the collapse of the economic part of the U.S. empire, and now it's the military that's what remains. Obama has taken that into account. All of his economic stimulus is going to finance all of his major appropriations as far as overseas programs goes to the military. So I think it's the financial military complex that has driven the U.S. into, particularly Obama, into this vision that American power can only be realized through a massive military commitment.
So now we have McChrystal sitting in Afghanistan and Pakistan on a new policy, so-called new policy, but a killer policy for sure. 2 million displaced people already in Pakistan. How do you see this unrolling in the next 6 months, in the next year? Is there any counter to it at all?
Yes, the counter is going to be out in the field. Pakistan, this is enormously costly war in a country economy that's almost a basket case. The Pakistan cannot sustain this offensive, and it's going to be a long war because it's a war against a people. It's not simply some armed gunmen that come in. They have links to tribes, to clans, to communities, etc. This is going to be a long, dirty war. It's already shaping up. So I think it's likely that this whole operation in Pakistan is not sustainable. Ultimately, the government is going to become terribly unpopular. They're going to have 3 or 4 million refugees without sanitary food, living in tents. They cannot sustain. I think the ultimate effect is that Obama is endangering his fragile client, and the possible outcome is a collapse of that government and debacle in Pakistan and increasing anti-U.S. forces coming to the fore there, whether they're Islamic, secular, or what have you. In Afghanistan, I think the tactics are going to alienate some of the major tribes and community organizations. This idea of emptying the pond to catch the fish is going to escalate the degree of opposition. So the net effect is these are going to be boomerangs. The little support that the U.S. had in Pakistan and Afghanistan is going to erode. We're going to have a major catastrophe in foreign policy.
What's in it for the people that make policy and profit from these things in this country? Why do they want Afghanistan? Why can't they just turn their back on the place?
The driving force in U.S. policy is not business. Just like the driving force in U.S. policy to Iran. I mean, why does the U.S. overlook billions of dollars in oil contracts, investments, trade with Iran? I think that the major force in shaping U.S. policy to Iran is Israel and its allies in the United States, the pro-Israel Zionist power configuration. Otherwise, it makes absolutely no sense. Iran, for example, cooperated with the U.S. in supporting Maliki in Iraq. It pursued the Taliban right after the U.S. invasion. It's agreed to recognize a two-state solution. What's the deal when you have so much economic benefits? It's the driving force and the interests represented are either the U.S. military-driven empire builders and the Zionists. I mean, this is so clear. The Zionists don't have much say in Afghanistan, but they support the general posture of U.S. military-driven foreign policy in South Asia and in the Middle East, in the Gulf. So I think this is an area where big oil manufacturing groups are not benefiting. It's a cost rather than a benefit from this drive. There's absolutely no benefit to going, economic benefit of going into Afghanistan. I mean, for every dollar that's come out of it, most of it is drug money. There's $1,000 going in as expenses. So even if you did a cost-benefit analysis of Afghanistan, it's a tremendous loser.
Jim Petras, thank you very much for being on Law & Disorder, and we'd love to have you back. Really appreciate this discussion.
Depressing but very fresh analysis, so thank you.
Okay, thank you for the invitation. We'll talk again in the future.
Absolutely. You take care.
Right, bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Clear the day, I'm alive. Ooh.
In his book, Gringo, A Coming of Age in Latin America, author Chesa Boudin travels through parts of Venezuela, the streets of Guatemala, and protests in Santiago, Chile. Boudin's narrative chronicles nearly a decade of on-the-road experiences in Latin America. He's captured the transformation in Latin America politics through the voices of the wealthy and the desperately poor. Seymour Hersh says in his review of the book, it's, quote, cheap beer, fried plantains, long dusty bus rides, radical politics, the repeated kindness of desperately poor people sharing what they have with an outsider. And Chesa Boudin's eagerness to share what he's seen and what he's feeling with sympathy and empathy as he tries to sort it all out. There's much to learn in this book. We're pleased to have Chesa Boudin with us today.
Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks. Great to be back.
Chesa, Gringo, A Coming of Age in Latin America. How come you wrote this book? What's it about? Tell us.
This is a book that really weaves together two different threads. One is my own personal journey, my own effort to make sense of my identity, my place in the world as a white, relatively privileged North American man, but also in a context where I was traveling throughout Latin America, living, working, studying in Latin America at a period of time when that region was experiencing a dramatic political shift to the left. So the story that I tell in the book is my own, and it's the story of the region and how they weave together and interplay.
When you talk about the coming of age and kind of figuring out who you are personally and politically at the same time traveling these various countries in Latin America, what do you mean by that?
Well, like many Americans, I studied Spanish in grammar school, but I didn't learn very much, and I really wanted to have the opportunity to become fluent in a foreign language. And so when I was 18, I headed off to Guatemala for my first trip ever out of the country on my own. I went, seeking a bit of an adventure, and I went hoping to learn the language and have a new experience before college. And ultimately, I fell in love with travel, fell in love with Spanish, fell in love with seeing the world through a different perspective. But there's something, I think, that gave me a somewhat unique approach to travel and to the way that I approach being in foreign countries, which is that I had grown up in a very political family. All four of my parents had been very involved in the anti-war movement, and both of my biological parents, Kathy Boudin and David Gilbert, were incarcerated in New York State maximum security prisons from the time that I was a baby. And so I went to live with friends of theirs when they were arrested, and I grew up in a certain sense, with a foot in two very different worlds, one of prison and one of privilege and opportunity. And so when I went to Latin America for the first time, I was already accustomed to seeing the world from different perspectives, to seeking out and analyzing what I encountered from these different perspectives. And I think I brought that approach to my travels. I always sought to travel by public bus, to interact with the poorest and the most humble people in the countries I visited, but as a white American, I also had access to the world of the local elites.
Talk to us also about the political overview of the book. You were there at a time when you initially got there where American neoliberalism policy was in the saddle. In the last few years, we've seen a real sea change in that. Talk to us about neoliberalism, what you saw and how you saw it go down the tubes.
The first couple chapters of the book, as you mentioned, are sort of my travels in Latin America, before the neoliberal model had really become fully bankrupt in a public way. And so I was in Guatemala, and I write about the impact of U.S. businesses and the sweatshops in Guatemala and the people I met. And from there I went to Chile, which was, a classic example. Naomi Klein uses it as one of the key examples in her book, Shock Doctrine, of the way that the U.S. government, in combination with the Pinochet regime, forced a series of neoliberal policies on the Chilean people, in an undemocratic way, in a horribly violent and brutal way. Then I happened to be in Argentina during the Argentine economic crisis in 2001. And that, in many ways is a classic example of the way that the neoliberal economic model failed, and failed in a very visible and tragic way for the people of Argentina. I sat in line for hours and hours simply to change money into local pesos. I watched entire families digging through garbage on the street. I watched street children begging for money. And I grappled in Argentina, as throughout the book, with my role as an outsider, with how to make sense of my own identity, given the politics and the political values that I had and that I'd grown up with, and faced with this tragic reality and actually recognizing the role that my government played in bringing about, in this case, the Argentine economic crisis, in Chile, in the Chilean case, in supporting the Pinochet regime, even as it tortured and killed the entire Chilean left.
Guatemala, Bolivia, Colombia, the United States played the overarching role in running and ruining all those countries.
Yeah, very, very significant role. And so that was something that, you know, I as an American, as a backpacker, and of course the great irony, Michael, is that I found time and time again that the poorest people, the most downtrodden, the most humble, the ones living, you know, 17 people in a two-bedroom apartment in the middle of the Amazon who took me in, those were the ones who were the most generous. Time and time again, the ones with the least were the ones who had the most to share and offer.
Talk to us about how you saw the United States getting pushed aside and people kind of coming into their own. I was particularly struck about your having the chance to be in Venezuela at the time of the Chavez government, and you're having actually a seat in the palace. What were things like there?
The time I spent in Venezuela, the years I spent in Venezuela, which make up a couple chapters of the book, were some of the most informative and educational in terms of my ability to imagine an alternative. And when you grow up in the United States, when the dominant economic and political model is one that comes out of Washington, all across the world, really, it can become difficult to even fathom what a different approach would look like. And that was what was so important about Venezuela, was the opportunity I had, as you said, working in the Chavez administration, working in think tanks, working with media from the U.S. and from Venezuela, to just watch the political process, the effort to, through democratic process, through popular participation, to recreate a political system that is not based on excluding the majority of people, on shutting them out, but rather on giving them a stake in the day-to-day functioning of their government, of their state, and empowering poor people, and giving poor people the opportunity to solve their own problems, instead of having people from another country or from another economic class come in and tell them what they need to do.
I know you talk about a lot about your time in Venezuela, Chesa. Can you give us some predictions of how you see things going now in Venezuela?
Well, it's hard to, it's, you know, one of the things that's great about Venezuela and that made it such a fun place for me to spend those years is that it's so dynamic, and it's the politics are so quickly changing and evolving, and there's always something exciting, something new, some new agenda, some new controversy. So it's a very exciting place to live, but it does make it difficult to predict what's coming next. Certainly, it seems clear that Chavez is you know, as popular as ever. I think the latest poll carried out actually by an opposition polling company, Data Analysis, has him near the 60% support mark. And this 10 years into his presidency, it's really remarkable. I think there are a few presidents in the world that have been able to maintain that kind of popularity that far into a presidency. That doesn't mean that it's going to stay forever. It doesn't mean that there aren't challenges and obstacles and real issues that he and his government will have to face. I think one of them, and one that was in the news a lot this past year, is the constitutional reform that did away with presidential term limits. And it was one that was very controversial in the United States.
What did you think of that?
It's a classic example of the way that developments in Venezuela, political developments, get manipulated and distorted in their presentation to a U.S. audience. And it doesn't mean that I supported it, but I do think that the way that it was presented was really quite dishonest. So let me give you a couple examples of what I mean. In Venezuela this past fall, they had a nationwide referendum in which every single citizen was able to vote, and they voted by a margin of more than 10% to approve a constitutional reform that did away with term limits across the country, not just for the president, but for other elected leaders as well. The way that we heard about that in the New York Times and other news outlets in the United States was really as though this were the downfall of Venezuelan democracy.
Like they care about democracy.
Well, exactly, right? We didn't care about it when we supported Pinochet in 73 in Chile. We didn't care about it when we supported the overthrow of Arbenz in Guatemala in 54. But now that's all of a sudden the priority. And the irony is, of course, it's not even as though the United States had term limits on the presidency until the 1950s.
And moreover, why shouldn't people have a right to keep somebody as president for more, say, than 8 years if they want to?
Exactly.
That's democratic, too.
Exactly. In fact, it's more democratic. Well, we have a Republican system in which we create checks on our government and on our people, and we can argue that that's better, but it's certainly not more democratic in the true meaning of the word democracy. So it's a real irony here. And in addition, you know, the U.S. government was supporting Venezuela's neighbor, Colombia, in its effort to get Uribe reelected in a process that required changing the Constitution of Colombia. So it's a real contradiction. It's a real double standard. And as you point out, the biggest irony of all is that they're actually doing something that's more democratic than our own system. And many of our closest democratic allies in Europe and in other parts of the world don't have any term limits whatsoever for their presidency. So the idea that this is somehow a bad thing or somehow the downfall of Venezuela's democracy is really ridiculous. On the other hand, my personal opinion is that it wasn't a good idea politically. I don't have any ethical problem with it. I don't have any institutional problem with the change that the Venezuelan people supported. I do think that from a political perspective, it was not a good use of President Chavez's political capital and his resources and his time and energy. I think there were more pressing problems in Venezuela. It took up an immense amount of his time to campaign for the reform. And I personally would have preferred to see that time and energy spent dealing with the corruption in the police force, the high crime rate, the problems with open sewage in some of the poor neighborhoods in Caracas that still exist, and also training new leadership. I think it's very important for the long-term viability of Venezuela's political experiment for there to be people besides Chavez who have a stake, who are credible, who have the ability to bring together the coalition of parties and social movements that have made this government possible. And Chavez can't be the only one who's capable of doing that. So I would have liked to have seen those resources, that energy, go into training new leadership, into solving some of the concrete problems that still exist. But again, that's not the point. The point is, you know, the way that it gets manipulated in the U.S. media is really problematic. And I think that's something that we all need to be aware of when we see news on Venezuela.
Let's move you into Bolivia now, Chesa. I see in your chapter that you actually went down into one of the mines and talked a lot with the miners, which is, from my bit of history I know about Bolivia, was certainly the key political organization through many years, actually having a revolution that took over the country in the 50s. And can you tell us something about that experience and what you think of Evo and what's going on in Bolivia and what may be the future? And, of course, it's a much smaller country, what, 8 or 9 million people in Bolivia, with the potential, I think, for actually feeding everybody. But give us some sense of both your experiences there as well as what your political thinking is.
Great, thanks. Well, you know, Bolivia is a fascinating country. It's a beautiful country to visit. It's always been one of my favorite places to travel to in Latin America. And the mining industry, as you point out, has a long history, and it's really been the backbone of the economy in Bolivia for generations. It's something that I use in the book as a lens through which to analyze and understand the country's current politics, and also the political developments that led to the election of Evo Morales, the you know, widely heralded as the country's first ever indigenous president in a country where more than half of the population identifies as indigenous.
So yeah, that fact to me is amazing. 500 years, I guess, since the Spanish, right?
Correct.
I mean, they never had an indigenous leader with over 50% of the country being indigenous. So
yes,
it's just a remarkable piece of information.
Yeah, and he's somebody who comes out of the coca industry. And this is, again, an example of the way that the U.S. government has been involved, often, you know, for the worse, both in terms of domestic issues in Bolivia and in terms of, you know, our bilateral relationship with the Bolivian government.
I remember when I once had a case that involved some textiles from Bolivia many years ago, ancient textiles. I was representing a tribe. We went to the Bolivian embassy in Washington, and the Bolivian ambassador and his wife were both wearing little gold coca leaves in their lapels, which was great.
Yeah, and you know, what they'll tell you in Bolivia is the coca leaf is not a drug. It's been part of the indigenous culture since before the Spanish arrived. For over 1,000 years, people have grown coca throughout the Andes. They make tea out of it. They use it for medicinal purposes. They chew it.
It forestalls hunger also. So when I think people were down in the mines and they would not get enough to eat, they would chew coca.
Exactly. And in fact, it was something the Spanish encouraged because they could get longer hours out of their slaves. But it's something that you still see. And I described this, and you know, I saw it on my visit into the mines. My friend who took me to see where his team worked actually encouraged me to bring a couple presents for the workers. And the things he suggested I bring were dynamite and coca leaves.
No, dynamite?
Dynamite and coca leaves.
Wait a second.
That's what those are the tools the miners use. And of course, you know, miners need dynamite. That's how they work.
But these are miners who are independent miners who don't get supplied by a company. I don't understand.
Well, the mining industry is extremely complicated. It's sort of, as I said, the backbone of the economy in Bolivia. And there's been a series of changes over the course of Bolivian history, which have had a really significant impact on the politics today. In many ways, creating the political movements that led to Evo Morales' rise. So I'll kind of run you through it very briefly. There's a lot more detail in the book. The mining industry was at the heart of the revolution back in the 50s, that, you know, sort of progressive revolution in Bolivia, which was quite short-lived. And you know, in during that revolution, there was a move towards nationalization of the mining industry. It was pretty centralized under the government. Prior to the revolution, it had been controlled by a few private-owned miners and families of mining barons. In the 1980s, under the tutelage of Jeffrey Sachs, there was a new economic program put forward in Bolivia, basically a neoliberal economic agenda in which the mines were privatized again, and thousands, tens of thousands of miners were fired. In that process, miners were forced to leave their mines, leave the high-altitude villages where the mines are located, and head out into other parts of the country in search of opportunities to provide food for their families. Many of those miners went to the slums around La Paz, the capital of Bolivia, and to a particular city called El Alto. Others went into the Chapare region of Bolivia, where coca is grown. And there's a huge influx of people from the mines to both the slums above La Paz and to the coca-growing regions. And the mining industry, because of its political history, because of its role in the 1952 revolution, had a history of labor organization, a history of being politicized. And so many of the people who left the mines, the first ones to be fired, in fact, were the ones who were labor organizers. And they went with their organizing experience, with their politics, into these new regions, and they organized where they went. There's a saying in Bolivia, which it doesn't rhyme in translation, but one of the miners I interviewed while I was there said to me, "The blood of the miners is the seeds of the revolution." What he meant was the miners were oppressed, the miners were fired, the miners were pushed down, but they then went on to organize the coca workers, to organize the neighborhoods in the slums. And those neighborhood organizations, the coca growers' unions, were the main groups that were visibly supporting Evo Morales in his rise to the presidency back in 2005.
Now, they're remarkably militant. I spent about 3 months there in 1989. In La Paz, there were strikes, pickets, and people putting themselves up on flagpoles in a mock sort of crucifixions almost every day. I mean, it was remarkably militant place. But let me ask you about Evo now. What's going on now? I mean, what kind of government do they have? How popular is Evo? What do you see that he's really doing there that's very positive, other than being indigenous and coming out of unions and people?
Yeah, well, it's a really challenging situation. I think one of the lessons I learned in researching the book and traveling, and that I try to write about and grapple with explicitly on the pages of the book, is that the left, the world over, has, I think, been got much more experience at being critical from the outside than at actually learning to govern from the inside. And one of the things a lot of people I talked to in Bolivia said to me is, "We elected Evo to do away with this junk, to do away with the neoliberal state, and now he's ruling over it. Now he's governing it." I think this is something that some people on the left also, are beginning to experience with aspects of the Obama administration as well. And there's a lot of lessons I think we can learn here in the United States from the challenges that the left in Latin America is having.
That's a good point. My son is going to probably work in Bolivia this summer, and we have lots of friends there, and they're basically, a number of them are what you would call to the left of Evo.
Right.
So is that's what you're sort of getting to at this point, if you can explain why?
Yeah, well, I think Evo is quite committed to the politics and policies that led to his election, to the people and the movements that elected him. But there are some fundamental contradictions between a lot of the values that those movements, those people on the left represent, and being a president or running a country. I mean, some of the things simply are not compatible. I'll give you a concrete example. One of my friends was involved in a local movement near La Paz around water rights, which has been a big issue in Bolivia. And he said, they were really active in supporting Evo's election. And once he got elected, Evo repaid them by appointing one of their leaders to a key position in the ministry that is responsible for dealing with water rights. And so, by all, on appearance, this is great. He's loyal to he recognizes the support they gave him. He appoints their guy to a key position. Everything, this is how the political process works in many countries, right? The problem is, as he pointed out, all of a sudden, their movement has lost its most vocal, articulate, experienced spokesperson to the government.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay, so right, exactly.
Right, and the government, of course, has lots of other pressures. All of a sudden, you're in the government. Well, you've got the people in suits and with the expense accounts talking to you. Those people not only are experienced and skilled at lobbying, but they also, regardless of what we think of their policies, this is the same issue in the United States. It's like, we don't need to support agribusiness, but we need to recognize that they feed tens of millions of people. So, in Bolivia, you don't need to like the companies that are administering the privatized water system, But you can't just do away with them overnight. And one of the real problems that Bolivia faces in every industry, in the water industry, in the mining industry, in the gas, oil, and, you know, and natural gas, is that these are industries that are expensive, capital-intensive, and technically complicated to administer. And the Bolivian government does not necessarily have the capital or the skills to do it. There was a lot of pressure on Evo early on to nationalize the gas industry. Bolivians, I think, rightly felt that their natural resources, gas in particular, were being exploited by foreign multinational companies and that the Bolivians were getting the short end of the stick. I think they're right about that. The problem is the Bolivian government does not have the resources to exploit the natural gas reserves. They don't have access to the technical expertise necessary to do so either. And so on some level, you can nationalize, but you still have a dependence on foreign capital. You still have a dependence on foreign technical expertise. How do you do it? What's the solution? And in many ways, I think this is where Venezuela and Cuba and other countries that have had a longer experience with left-wing governments come into play. The Cubans have been very generous in supporting Venezuela, Bolivia, other countries with medical practitioners and doctors. The Venezuelans have been active in developing new university systems, training a new generation of Venezuelans to go into medicine, to go into oil with a social perspective rather than a profit perspective. And I think it's going to take time for the values and the social norms in these countries to change enough so that you have a generation of bureaucrats, of technicians, of miners, and so on, who are committed to a more humane, socially oriented way of life.
Chesa Boudin is the author of a wonderful new book called Gringo, A Coming of Age in Latin America. It's Chesa's 8, 9, 10-year odyssey through Latin America on a bus.
From the time he was 18 to the time, which is now age 28. We've talked mostly in this interview about your political understanding of the countries that you saw. But this book is both political and personal. And I think that's what makes it such a very fine book. You know, I go visit your father, David Gilbert, and I know you go visit him a lot. And I imagine that the two of you would go back and forth when you were creating this book. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about David's situation and what it was like collaborating with him when you'd visit him and the insights that he gave you.
Right. Well, yeah, you know, my dad's been in prison since I was 14 months old. And so I grew up used to, and it was normal for me to go through a metal detector every time I wanted to give him a hug. That was how I grew up. That was the childhood that I knew. And he's somebody who has very strong political beliefs, and he's very committed to his principles and to his political principles in particular. But he was very excited, I think, during my travels and over the course of this book to learn from my experiences, to have the opportunity to discuss and get my firsthand accounts and sort of, you know, get behind the scenes of what is reported in the newspaper. Certainly we have our differences and you know, different approaches. I think, you know, one classic example is that he would have loved to have seen the book be much more focused on the politics. So the things we talked about today, I think, are what he's most interested in. And, of course, much of the book, as you point out, is about me and my experience, and it's also about individual people I met, the stories they told me, the experiences they shared, the miners in Bolivia, sure, but also the fishermen in the Ecuadorian Amazon, the people living in the barrios high up above the hills of Caracas, who took me into their homes, who took me into their workplaces, who took me into their families, and ultimately who took me into their hearts. And those are the people whose stories I tell, the personal journey that I had, sure, but also all the politics is narrated throughout the book by the people I met, by the friendships I built, by the unique and particular experiences that I happened to have on the road, rather than some sort of overarching academic political analysis.
I think that that's the charm of the book, really a fine interweaving of both of those threads. We're so grateful for your doing this for everybody, Chesa. It's called Gringo by Chesa Boudin. We can't recommend it more heartily to our listening audience. Go out and get the book. You'll enjoy it very much. You'll enjoy learning about Chesa, and you'll learn something about Latin America as well. Chesa Boudin, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
And I can't yet, Chesa, give you Jeremy Scahill's endorsement yet, but he came into the studio just now, saw the book, and says he already has the book. Is that right, Jeremy?
I do have it. In fact, you know, when I heard about this was when I was launching my political career in Bill Ayer's living room right after the election. No, I haven't launched my political career, but that is when I heard about the book was when I was visiting Bill Ayer's in Chicago not long ago.
Oh,
and I really look forward to reading it, Cheza.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm a great admirer of your work, and look forward to your next book as well.
Your check is in the mail.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, good luck to you down in South Africa, yeah. Cheza.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, great one.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
You take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.